This is the third day of this October 2008 seven-day session. And we will resume reading from the letters and lectures of the Chinese Zen master Da Hui and from a book called Swampland Flowers, translated by Christopher Cleary. This is another letter in reply to one of his disciples, presumably. Da Hui writes, "Once you have achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, you must make earnest effort." Notice that. It's not you must make earnest effort to achieve peaceful stillness, but once you have achieved peaceful stillness of body and mind, you must make earnest effort. Do not immediately settle down in peaceful stillness. In the teachings, this is called the deep pit of liberation, much to be feared. Well, one of Da Hui's most noted admirers, Hakuin, also used to inveigh against this, what he called dead sitting and silent illumination. Warning about the tendency we have to sink into a quiet state and stay there. It is so enticing in our busy lives when we find a bit of real peace of mind to want to linger there. But that peace of mind is that we find in Zazen and in Sesshin, it is a conditioned phenomenon. That means when the conditions change, it will pass. So it's sort of like taking a vacation. Someone recently pointed out to me that the word vacation comes from the same root as to vacate. And this is what we're doing in Zazen. We're vacating the noise, the stuff of the mind. And so it's variously been called the deep pit of liberation, the pit of pseudo-emancipation is another translation for this feared state in Zen. Isn't it wonderful to be part of a meditation tradition that sees mere peacefulness and calmness as a poor thing to settle for? There are other forms of meditation where this is seen as all there is to strive for is just to be peaceful. It's actually right about this stage of Sesshin that we begin to face this danger of simply settling into a quiet state and kind of smacking our lips and smiling to ourselves and thinking that this is something worthy of staying in. He continues, you must make yourself turn freely, like a gourd floating on the water, independent and free, not subject to restraints, entering purity and impurity without being obstructed or sinking down. Only then do you have a little familiarity with the school of the patch-robed monks. If you just manage to cradle the uncrying child in your arms, what's the use? A danger that's related to this is wanting to avoid activity. We reach some measure of inner quiet, and then we just want to be left alone, just so we can stay in our precious little quiet realm and not have to deal with anyone else or any kind of challenges. This is a debased Zen. This is not real practice. Real practice is just letting that go and just responding freely as called for and all of the circumstances of one's life. Not trying to escape or retire from these challenges, but to step boldly into them and be ready to help others. This is a danger that has played out in Sesshin so many times. I get wind of something going on where someone, and as part of their job, something needs to be done. Something has come up, something extra, or someone is sick or something, and there's a little extra work to be done. And it is so disheartening to hear when people will say, oh, no, that's not my job. I want to get back to the Zendo. I don't want this to interfere with my practice. Like one's practice is this fragile little thing that you have to protect from the real world. This is such a misunderstanding of practice. Practice is not just sitting. That is practice. Stepping in where you're needed and helping out. That's practice. The real problem is not just the unwillingness to help when it's needed, but the problem to the individual is that very withholding state of mind. No, I want to go practice. I don't want to be bothered with these other things, this extra work. That is a mind state of egoism. Me first. So the person who responds that way, that negatively that way, is really hurting herself or himself. And just reinforcing one's sense of separation. It in terms of ego attrition, could very well be more valuable to in that situation to forego the sitting and just spend longer doing what needs to be done. And that's what this is all about, is ego attrition, isn't it? It's freeing ourselves from this self-concern. There it is. There's good practice at it. That's why we call it practice. There's a good way to practice it, is to respond when called on, when there is a genuine need. Even people who have been practicing a long time, I've heard, have this attitude sometimes. They fall into this whining about being asked to do something that will keep them out of the Zendo for a few minutes more or half an hour more or something. Who's going to do these things if not senior people? You must make yourself turn freely, like a gourd floating on the water. It's a wonderful image often used in Zen to show the kind of freedom and no self, just adapting to circumstances, just adapting, responding to what's needed. Independent and free, he says, not subject to restraints. Entering purity and impurity without being obstructed or sinking down. So to be able to do both. To purity we could see as a state of circumstances such as at the Zendo, sitting. And impurity would be situations where we have to encounter things that may not be as conducive to what we normally think of as practice. So another example of this is we've seen over and over through the years is where someone breaches sesshin, someone from the outside wanders usually unaware into sesshin, and someone has to deal with that person. And the monitors may not be anywhere nearby, so someone has to take it upon himself or herself to step forward and say, "May I help you?" and then deal with it and try to do it as simply and cleanly and briefly as possible. The opposite. Which can cause problems to other people, is just ignoring the person and hoping someone else will take care of it. When there is the resistance to responding in this free, helpful way, it really grows out of one's likes and dislikes, one's attachments to one's preferences. I'd rather not, or I'd rather be doing that. And that, we know, is the source of so many of our difficulties and our suffering, ultimately, is acting on the basis of our preferences. That's why it is emphasized so strongly by Sun Tzan in his Affirming Faith and Mind, the way he hammers away at that over and over again. The next letter is longer. It's to some other Chinese person, and is how it begins. If your mind does not run off searching or think falsely or get involved with objects, then this very burning house of passion is itself the place to escape the three worlds. Didn't Buddha say, quote, not depending on or abiding in any situation, not having any discrimination, one clearly sees the vast establishment of reality and realizes that all worlds and all things are equal and non-dual. And that's the end of the Buddha's statement. And then Dawi says, thus a bodhisattva of the far-going stage goes beyond all in the two vehicles by virtue of the power of the knowledge and wisdom which he practices. Though he has attained the treasury of the Buddha realm, yet to teach he appears in the realms of delusion. Though he has transcended the ways of delusion, yet he appears to practice the stuff of delusion. Though he appears to act the same as outsiders, He does not abandon the Buddhist teachings. Though he appears to go along with all that is worldly, he's perpetually practicing all world-transcending ways. These are the real expedient devices within the burning house of passion. So as we said yesterday, this is sometimes called being in the world but not of the world. Not shrinking from situations where worldly forces are potentially threatening one's peace of mind, let's say. Not, in other words, not dividing the world into what is pure and what is impure, what is higher and lower. There are spiritual traditions that use this kind of vocabulary just routinely. Higher level of consciousness, a lower level of consciousness. It's not that these have no validity at all. You know, we can say that at times we act out of our higher selves and at times not. But the more we use dualistic language like that, the more we get drawn into it as and get stuck with it. So let's see, I can imagine being invited to go to some event at your workplace, maybe related to the holidays. It would not be a sign of a mature practitioner to decline because you're afraid of mixing with the kind of things that might happen there. Unless, of course, there are situations where that might really show some wisdom, especially if, say, if you have there's going to be a lot of drinking at an event like that and you have a problem with drinking, it very well might be better not to go. The worst thing is to shrink from involving yourself with others because you think you're special, because you practice Zen. In Japan, it is a real problem getting together socially and not ending up drinking quite a bit. Roshi has spoken to this, Roshi Kaplow, about the occasional social event there where there'd be a good deal of drinking and the kind of skills that he developed to avoid violating the fifth precept of not abusing alcohol or drugs. And the same with his teachers, both Harada Roshi and his disciple Tangan Roshi. Roshi Kaplow would say maybe have just the tiniest sip of sake, just to join in, be one with people, but leave it at that, to have no more than that. Roshi said he finally learned after having so much liquor poured in his glass when he didn't want it, to just say that he had stomach problems. And then they leave you alone, he said. Well, there are, I suppose, so many ways to apply what Da Wei is saying here that one has to just find on one's own. It is a fine line. Becoming one with, when does becoming one with slip into just giving way to a kind of whatever herd mentality, or misguided behavior. Spiritual practice generally has been called walking the razor's edge. This can be understood in many ways, but one is this mixing with people who don't share your spiritual aspiration, and knowing when it's harmful to just join in with whatever people are doing, and when you can do that without compromising your commitment to your practice. He goes on, if people who study transcendent wisdom, prajna, abandon these expedients and go along with passions, they will certainly be controlled by the demons of delusion. And while yielding to sense objects, to impose theories and say that affliction is itself enlightenment and ignorance is itself great wisdom, to act in terms of existence with every step while talking of emptiness with each breath, without admonishing oneself for being dragged along by the power of habitual action, to go on and teach others to deny cause and effect, the vicious poison of misguided delusion has entered the guts of people who act like this. They want to escape from passion, but it's like trying to put out a fire by pouring on oil. Aren't they to be pitied? Only having penetrated all the way through can you say that affliction is itself enlightenment and ignorance is identical to great wisdom. There are teachers who justify their wanton behavior, their drunken behavior and lecherous behavior by airily declaring that, after all, the passions are themselves bodhi, the afflictions are themselves enlightenment. Horseshit. Just doesn't even bear comment. Within the wondrous mind of the original vast quiescence, pure, clear, perfect illumination, there is not a single thing that can cause obstruction. It is like the emptiness of space. Even the word Buddha is something alien, to say nothing of there still being passions or afflictions as the opposite. And now another letter. This affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. Beautiful. Let me read that again. This affair, of course, means this self-nature, this mind that we all have in common. This affair is like the bright sun in the blue sky, shining clearly, changeless, and motionless, without diminishing or increasing. It shines everywhere in the daily activities of everyone, appearing in everything. Though you try to grasp it, you cannot get it. Though you try to abandon it, it always remains. It is vast and unobstructed, utterly empty. Like a gourd floating on water, it cannot be reined in or held down. Since ancient times, when good people of the path have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death, able to use it fully. There is no deficit or surplus. Like cutting up sandalwood, each piece is it. When fragrant sandalwood is cut up, each piece is equally fragrant. This statement, when people of the path have attained this, they've appeared and disappeared in the sea of birth and death. It's not referring just to ordinary birth and death, literal death of the body and birth of the body, but that birth and death in Zen is understood as a continuous process. It's going on all the time. This is the evanescence of reality, the world, phenomena. Like bubbles forming and breaking up almost instantaneously. We live in a world of flux, of ceaseless change, moment by moment. It's all happening so fast that our senses cannot perceive this change. Things appear, other than bubbles and a few other things, things appear to be relatively substantial. Certainly ourselves. But it's just because we see that things that way because of the limitations of our sense faculties. We don't see at the subatomic level where everything is in motion, everything is in flux. It's so confirming to see clips showing from laboratories showing cellular activity. Kind of shimmering, the constant shimmering movement of what seemed to be very solid things. He goes on, where do the passions of birth and death arise from? Where can it be located when gathering the causes to produce the effect? Since there is no place to locate it, Buddha is illusion and Dharma is illusion. So that is, since there is no fixed thingness to things, there is no permanent, fixed, unchanging existence to things. Buddha is illusion, Dharma is illusion. The three worlds, 25 states of being. These are all Buddhist concepts, categories. The sense organs, sense objects, and consciousnesses are utterly empty. When you get to this realm, there's no place to put even the word Buddha. If even the word Buddha has no applicability, where is there true thusness, Buddha nature, enlightenment, or nirvana? Thus, Fudaishi said, he's one of the great lay masters, enlightened masters, fearing that people will give rise to a view of annihilation, we provisionally establish empty names. In other words, if we just tell ourselves, okay, everything is, and there's no existence, nothing exists, everything's empty, well, we are not seeing the whole. Because even as everything is empty, still there is thingness. Imagine someone enthralled by the teaching of emptiness, saying, everything is empty, everything is empty, and walking in front of a car. Well, everything is empty, and yet it's not, and yet it is. Phenomena are empty of absolutely fixed permanence. And so we have this whole rich, vast vocabulary where we assign labels to different objects, different states, different concepts, principles. He goes on. Students of the path who do not understand this principle are always going to the stories of people of old, entering the path looking for mysteries and subtleties and marvels, seeking interpretations and understanding. They are unable to see the moon and forget the pointing finger, unable to cut directly through with one blow. This is what Jung Chia called understanding the empty fist, as though there were actually something in it, falsely making up wonders within the senses and their objects. There's a footnote here, it's well put, so I'll just read it. The Buddha's teachings are all skillful expedients suited to the circumstances and potentials of the listeners. This is likened to holding out a closed fist as if it contained some treat to pacify a crying child. So again, this master Jung Chia called this understanding the empty fist as though there were actually something in it. He's really addressing a real stubborn problem in Zen, are those who cling to concepts or principles, Buddhist concepts or principles, who become attached to ideas about Zen and Buddhism. And there's so many ways we can fall prey to this without realizing it. Most people have an inner world, of concepts and ideas without recognizing them as concepts and ideas. And then he takes aim at another misguided practitioner. He says, there's another sort. As soon as they hear a teacher speak of such an affair, they still use their conceptual minds to figure it out and say, if it's like this, then won't I fall into emptiness? 10 out of 10 gentlemen of affairs entertain this kind of view. I guess gentleman affairs means worldly people, non-monks, I suppose. I have no choice but to tell them, you haven't ever reached emptiness, so what are you afraid of? It's as if you're trying to leap out of the water before the boat has capsized. When I see that they don't understand, I don't spare the mouthwork, but try once more to create trailing vines for them. And trailing vines in this context means additional verbal pointers or any kinds of teaching which the teacher offers the student to help pull the student out of his misunderstanding. I try to create trailing vines for them. I say, this one who fears falling into emptiness, has he been emptied or not? If your eyes aren't empty, how can you see forms? If your ears aren't empty, how could you hear sounds? If your nose isn't empty, how could you smell scents? If your tongue isn't empty, how could you taste flavors? If your body weren't empty, how could you feel contact? If your intellect weren't empty, how could you distinguish the myriad things? Someone once noted, if a shirt didn't have holes, you couldn't wear it. And then he goes on, didn't Buddha say that there is no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no form, sound, scent, flavor, touch, or phenomenon, no sense organs or sense objects or consciousnesses of sensation, no 25 states of being. When those of power want to investigate this one great affair to the end, they all break down their facades and with bold spirit draw their spines up straight. Do not go along with the feelings of others. Take your own constant point of doubt, that is, questioning, and stick it on your forehead. Always be as if you owed someone millions with nothing to repay with when pressed for payment, fearful of humiliation by others. Only thus will you have some direction in the task of finding urgency where there is no urgency, getting busy where there is no pressure, and finding importance where there is no importance. Here he's addressing the problem of flagging motivation, of becoming complacent. And he's using this analogy of of having nothing, owing someone millions with nothing to repay, and being ever anticipating the judgment day, the time when the debt has to be paid, as a way of encouraging us, even when we feel no urgency, we feel no pressure and no particular importance in these things, to try to imagine how we might summon up this drive, this aspiration. It is so easy to fall into complacency and all the way through into this realm of quietude, peace and calm. And then he urges us, work diligently day and night, while eating and drinking, when joyful or angry, in clean places or unclean places, in family gatherings, when entertaining guests, when dealing with official business in your post, when concluding a betrothal. All of these are first-class times to make efforts to arouse and alert yourself and awaken. This is all another way of saying a rewording of this verse that we do at the very end of each night in Sesshin. Even as night darkens the green earth, the wheel turns. Death follows birth. The wheel turns. Here too, it's because of our the limitations of our sense perceptions, or maybe just a lack of imagination, we don't clearly perceive the passage of time and how it is draining away constantly like sand through an hourglass. And we all know this. We all know it in our heads. We get it. But how many of us use this indisputable fact of transiency, of impermanence, use it to fuel our practice? How many of us take it seriously? There'll be time. We just see the years stretching out endlessly before us. Next time, next sesshin, next sitting, next lifetime. Or using the excuse that my life is just so busy, I have so many responsibilities, so many things to do, how can I really buckle down and devote myself to practice? Again, as though practice just means sitting. Practice means awareness, vigilance, wakefulness, non-clinging, non-attachment, letting go. Practice is letting go, moment by moment. It's not just sitting. Letting go of one's agenda, letting go of one's opinions, letting go of one's preferences. That's practice. Practice at its richest, most valuable. The sitting is just to enable us to do that, to let go of the attachments, let go of the clinging, let go of the preferences. That's what the sitting is for, to enable us to do that. But the The letting go is the key thing, and we practice that in the sitting, the letting go. And then he cites famous cases where lay people who were had as many responsibilities and busyness as anyone found a way. In the old days, the military governor, Li Wenho, was able to practice Chan and attain great penetration and great enlightenment while in the thick of wealth and rank. When Yang Wen Kung successfully practiced Chan, he was dwelling in the Imperial Hanlin Academy. When Chang Wu Qin studied Chan, he was the minister for transport in Kyangxi. These three elders are examples of this not destroying the worldly aspect while speaking of the real aspect. And then Dawei says, when has it ever been necessary to leave wife and children, quit one's job, chew on vegetable roots? Yeah, who ever thought that was necessary? And cause pain to the body. Here he's talking about those who think that the only true practice is an ascetic practice of self-deprivation and isolation. Those of inferior aspiration shun clamor and seek quietude, and so they enter the ghost cave of dead tree Chan, entertaining false ideas that only thus can they awaken to the path. If you can manage not to forget the matter of birth and death while in the midst of the passions of the world, then even though you do not immediately smash the lacquer bucket of ignorance, nevertheless you will have planted deep the seed wisdom of transcendental knowledge, prajna. In another lifetime you will appear and save your mental power. You won't fall into evil dispositions. You'll overcome that sinking down into the defilement of passion. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.